falling, floating, weightless, calling, calling home.
Welcome to episode 25 of our Planet Earth series, in which we look at our home planet. In this evening's episode, we have features on the EquiWatch Australia program. Astronaut Moonwalker Ed Mitchell tells us about viewing the Earth. COVID and space. Yes, there is a relationship. Astronaut Story Musgrave pops in. And also the radar mapping satellite is a major part of our story this evening. So, let's go with EquiWatch Australia. This is a CSIRO project which aims to safeguard Australia's freshwater and coastal resources. The goal is to establish a comprehensive ground-to-space national water quality monitoring system. An additional goal is to grow Australia's high-tech space industry. This will include an extensive network of Earth observation satellites and ground-based sensors placed throughout Australia's rivers and waterways to manage the health of inland and coastal waters. The system will give water managers real-time updates, predictive analytics, and forecast warnings. Natural events such as toxic blooms, the contamination of drinking water, and excess runoff from irrigation will also be monitored. A few months ago, a study by the University of New South Wales, Canberra, concluded that EquiWatch would enhance water quality management in Australia. They were able to identify a system design that addresses the goals and is feasible to construct, commission, and operate. It did, however, note that the system would require further detailed engineering analyses. Earth observation satellites currently only provide 60 to 70% coverage for major Australian water bodies. While some inland waterways are monitored directly by testing, this data is not routinely combined with the satellite data. Now, development of EquiWatch is already underway and the first satellite launch will be in 2026. Well, let's go to Edgar Mitchell, one of only 12 people who's walked on the moon. And he has a spoken imagination, which he did at one of his seminars, on the Earth from space. It's his own guided visualization.
I love space, for all kinds of reasons. For myself, and I'm being personal, it's a new relationship to nature and the universe.
Okay, I have put the wrong one on. So let's stop that. And I don't have time to do the other one, so let's jump ahead. This is Story Musgrave we're now hearing from. He was going to be up later in the show, but we'll put him on now. And we'll get Ed Mitchell up shortly. And this is Story Musgrave, who's one of my favourite astronauts. And this is why he loves space.
I love space for all kinds of reasons. For myself, and I'm being personal, it's a new relationship to nature and the universe. To look at Earth from this perspective, to look at the contrast of colors, to look at our home, to look at a place where unless you put telephoto lens or high-power binoculars, you really don't see national boundaries. You get a new perspective of your home from a distance. It's against that deep, dark background. And you say, wow, that really is a beautiful place. The contrast, the colors are incredible. You go round and round the Earth. You can spend an hour and a half just looking at it from space, the cloud patterns. You look at the universe out there, the brightness of the stars, the planets, the speeds, the sunsets, all that kind of thing. Space is a kind of magical place because we have evolved and we have been designed by having that force between us and gravity. And now, so in an evolutionary sense, here we are kind of floating around, and we really weren't designed to be floating around. So that gives it a really kind of mystical, magical place. I think those are the two crucial things what you look at with the eyes out there, the universe, the heavens, looking at the earth, looking at home, without national boundaries, thinking about the global whole, thinking about all of humanity and its relationship to the universe.
This is Planet Earth. You're looking at Planet Earth. Bop, 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 bop. This is Planet Earth.
Now, dating back at least as far as ancient Greece, humans have sought to understand the seasonal nature of illness. Modern technology, mostly Earth-observing satellites, has revolutionized our ability to continuously monitor environmental conditions on a global scale. Ancient observers could scarcely have imagined how we do this. However, even though more information than ever is available for analysis, explaining why some diseases have seasonal cycles and others do not remains a challenge. An additional challenge is predicting the precise timing of these cycles. Now, if we could do this, it would mitigate potential harmful impacts on society. Well, last year and this year, the impetus to address this issue has increased as a result of the global pandemic of the SARS-CoV-2 novel coronavirus and the disease it causes, COVID-19. In response, NASA, the European Space Agency, and the Japan Aerospace Exploration Agency have joined forces. They will use the collective scientific power of their Earth-observing satellite data to document planet-wide changes in the environment and human society. The three space agencies have created a joint COVID-19 Earth Observation Dashboard. This online resource allows the public and medical researchers to search multiple satellite data records in a user-friendly way. You can track changes in the air and water quality, climate change, economic activity, and agriculture. Now, this feature from the Goddard Space Flight Center in Maryland describes the new Earth Observation Dashboard.
The novel coronavirus led to changes in human activities around the globe. As a result of city to countrywide lockdowns, some bodies of water have run clearer, emissions of pollutants have temporarily declined, and transportation and shipment of goods have decreased. We can see some of these changes from space. NASA, ESA, and JAXA have partnered to make data from their fleet of satellites accessible on the new COVID-19 Earth Observation Dashboard. You can search through various signals of the COVID lockdowns as they're visible from space. First up, economic indicators. We'll look at Dunkirk in France. A chart shows how many ships were available at piers over time in imagery from Sentinel-2. We can also look at finished goods production, like in Beijing. Clicking on the blue dot pulls up a chart showing how many new cars were visible in ALOS-2 and Sentinel-1 satellite imagery. We can see other economic indicators, like electric lights seen from space. We'll look at California. Clicking on the EO data button zooms into the imagery from the NASA NOAA SUMI NPP satellite. You can compare lights from before and during the COVID lockdowns, and you can zoom in even further for a closer look at the images. We can also investigate environmental indicators, like air quality. We'll look at the concentration of nitrogen dioxide, an air pollutant released by human activities, like driving cars and power plants, measured by the Tropomi instrument from Copernicus Sentinel-5P satellites. You can compare global NO2 concentrations from before and during COVID lockdowns, or zoom and pan to specific locations. We can investigate similar measurements of global carbon dioxide from OCO2 over the entire planet, and GOSAT satellites over individual city areas. You can also click on cities like Tokyo and see greenhouse gas column data for the annual change over the last few months. water quality data over a time series in the North Adriatic Sea show a drop and then subsequent increase in chlorophyll concentrations, which might reflect changes in both natural conditions like winds and currents, and in human activities like agriculture and sewage runoff. You can also compare chlorophyll concentrations in coastal areas, like the Venice Lagoon, where the drop is partly the result of decreased human activity. There are more data indicators to come, so you can continue to explore the changes caused by COVID-19 lockdowns as we see them from space.
The collaboration between NASA, ESA, and JAXA was introduced by Thomas Zurbuchen, the Associate Administrator of the Science Mission Directorate at NASA's Washington, D.C. headquarters.
During times of crisis like the world is enduring now, we are forced to think differently. And with a crisis of the scale of the COVID-19 pandemic, we are challenged with a very human question. What can we do to help? It is from times like these that great things can be accomplished. NASA, ESA, and JAXA collectively represent a unique and valuable human asset, Earth-observing instruments in space that we can use every day to benefit society and advance scientific knowledge about our home planet. As this pandemic spread across the globe, scientists began to see from space how patterns of human activity were changing and how those changes affected the environment. The pandemic was not only leaving a staggering toll of human suffering, it was having a global impact that we could document from space. Our three space agencies realized that if we could combine forces, we could bring a more powerful set of analytical tools to bear on this fast-moving crisis. We have a long and very strong relationship of cooperation and collaboration. We know how to work together, and we realized that we needed to act quickly if we were to capture critical global observations of the changes as the world reacted to the spread of the virus. So NASA, ESA, and JAXA began building on an accelerated schedule a public web portal to synthesize our most relevant data and analytical tools. What we were releasing today, the COVID-19 Earth Observation Dashboard, is the result of that intensive effort. Today, we present version 1.0 of the dashboard, which includes key indicators of air and water quality, climate change, and economic activity. We will be adding more information in the weeks and months ahead, including a look at agricultural production around the world. We hope to learn a great deal from the data collected here as the world recovers from the pandemic. This collaborative effort has given us a deep appreciation of how much we can accomplish when we work together.
The European contribution to this COVID-19 Earth Observation Dashboard was introduced by Josef Aschbacher, who is the Director General of the European Space Agency's Earth Observations Programs.
COVID-19 is a global crisis. It is a health crisis. It is an economic crisis. And is a crisis for humanity. So therefore, as European Space Agency, we have looked at our assets, that means our satellites, and see how we can help providing information based on our satellites for the benefit of decision makers, but also the people. We have monitored economic indicators, we have monitored health indicators like air pollution, water pollution, but also economic indicators like number of cars parked in parking lots, number of planes in different airports, but also different productions of different factories, and see how we can monitor during the lockdown what happens in the economy and with the people. These assets, which we provide from space with free information derived from Copernicus data, which is the European program led by the European Commission, we are very happy to share with everyone in a free and open format. What we have done is we have created a dashboard, and this dashboard allows to have time series of critical information over different areas and therefore compare information. But I'm particularly glad to say that this is not only a European effort. We have joined forces with the global space powers, in particular with NASA, but also with JAXA, the Japanese Space Agency, and really combined the assets which we have in the US, in Japan, in Europe, in order to derive this information and provide information related to COVID to the citizens worldwide in a global dashboard, which we jointly offer to you today.
This is the Space Show.
On FM, online, and on TuneIn, 24/7. This is 88.3 Southern FM.
This is planet Earth. You're looking at planet Earth. Ba, 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 ba. This is planet Earth.
Yes, our 25th episode of our Planet Earth series. And we found Edgar Mitchell. He did walk on the moon, and we found him around the other side of the moon having a nosy there at what's been happening. But he's back now, and this is a spoken imagination at one of his seminars called Earth from Space, a Guided Visualization.
For our guided visualization, I would like for you to get comfortable, get relaxed, and either close your eyes or concentrate on one of these pictures. And let's take a little trip in our imaginations out into space, and I will describe to you what I was experiencing at that time, so that we will have a kind of common mindset as we go into the rest of the afternoon. So, if you're nice and comfortable and quiet, relaxed in your body, use your imagination and your awareness to experience yourself, your level of comfort. Feel the energy of the persons around you. Feel the fine energy of this room. Be relaxed, be aware. And now let's imagine that we pop right out of our bodies and we pop right out of this auditorium up into the bright blue sky and the warm sunlight over Connecticut. And we can see the coastline. We can see all the cities and the green forest and the highways and the ocean and the sound. And let's keep moving up higher and higher and higher. And we can see the coastline all the way from Nova Scotia clear down to Florida as we get higher. We see off to the west the expanses of Pennsylvania. And as we move a little bit to the west, we want to have the sun at our back. If we move to the west, we see all of that heartland of the United States and up to the Great Lakes and down to the Gulf of Mexico, and we get out further and further and further. And then let's imagine that we move around to the west further, still in sunlight, and we get out over the Pacific Ocean, crossing the west coast and seeing the coastline from Canada down to Mexico, the vast reaches of the Pacific Islands, the Japanese Islands, the Chinese coastland. We see all the islands of the Pacific. And then we can bring into view the Saudi Peninsula, subcontinent of Australia, the African coast. And I would like you to continue to move out in your imagination until you can see the Earth as you see it in these pictures, about the size of a baseball held in front of you, a magnificent little globe, blue and white, the white fleecy clouds, the thin layer of atmosphere, the reds and browns of the desert areas, the greens of the forest and the vegetated areas. And as you can see, as you look at it, the political boundaries are not there. The evidence of humankind is not there at this distance. We're out several Earth diameters now. And what you experience is this little haven of life, of beauty, grandeur. Perhaps the only haven for life in our galaxy, and perhaps not. That we don't know for sure. And as we look beyond our planet, and we see in the blackness beyond it, with the warmth of the sun at our backs, we see the deepest black we've ever experienced, punctuated by the pinpoint, steady light of billions and billions of stars in far greater profusion than one can ever see from the surface of the Earth. 10 times as many stars as is possible to see even on the clearest night from the surface of the Earth. And as I gazed at that on the way home, having completed a successful mission on the lunar surface, what occurred to me in a flash of insight, a very deep experience, was that it's all connected. It's all a part of me, and I'm a part of it, and there is a connectedness. The very molecules of my body, the very molecules of the spacecraft in which we're traveling, were forged in the furnace of those stars at least 10 billion years ago. And then eventually came to reside in our solar system, on our planet, in such a way could eventually form our bodies and our spacecraft. And that as I looked out into the vastness of the cosmos, I recognized that connectedness. I recognized in a flash of insight and a euphoric feeling that our scientific description of ourselves, of how we got here, who we are, where we're going, and why, is incomplete and flawed, and that our religious cosmologies, for all of us, all cultures, have their cosmology, their story, their myth, if you will, of how we came about, and what is our purpose, and why we're here, and where we're going, that all of our religious cosmologies are archaic and flawed as well, and that the task of we humans at this point is to pull ourselves together and to create a new understanding, a new story, a new knowledge of our existence. It was a powerful experience, one that has pushed me in the direction, a different direction for the next 20 years, and the one which I'm sharing with you today. I would like for you to think about those thoughts and what I've just said for a few seconds. Let them sink deeply into your awareness. And then we will begin our reentry back here to the Greenwich Auditorium. But see that Earth, see those stars, see the immensity of the cosmos, and experience that not with your mind alone, but with your entire being. Experience what it is to recognize that you and the cosmos, that Earth, those billions of stars and galaxies and galactic clusters, are all connected. connected. In not some etheric way, but in some very tangible physical way, which we'll talk about later. All right, now, let's start our reentry back to Earth, back to this auditorium, being very careful not to enter too quickly, not to re-enter too quickly. The heat gets too fierce. But come in relaxed and comfortable. Find your place back in this auditorium, in your seat, being careful to select the correct body. And when everyone is back with us, we will open our eyes and continue. We leave anyone in space? Everyone here. Okay. I assume everyone's here. If you're not, hold up your hand, please.
That was the late Edgar Mitchell, one of only 12 people who have walked on the moon. And as you heard there, asking us to look at the Earth in a different light than we might have done otherwise.
Earth below us, drifting, falling, floating, weightless.
A radar mapping satellite collaboration is underway between the Indian Space Research Organisation and the Goddard Space Flight Centre. This feature from Goddard explains what NISAR is.
Pretty much anything that you can observe on the land and coasts, and sometimes even in the ocean, NISAR will have an application. Very exciting mission, generating an enormous amount of data that will keep the science community and the applications community busy for a long time.
NISAR is a partnership mission between NASA and ISRO, the Indian Space Research Organization. It's a collaborative project.
And we'll be collecting data for all around the whole Earth for all of the land masses.
Looking at volcanoes, earthquakes, landslides, other natural hazards that occur in the crust of the Earth.
A movement of sea ice, movement of glaciers, how much forest land is growing or being reduced.
Because it can image at night and through clouds, it can allow us to see through storms.
It's really going to allow us to see things changing in areas where we can't with other satellites.
NISAR is going to open our eyes to the potential of this technique for seeing the ground in places that otherwise has been obscured.
So every 12 days we will map the land masses, and then we can take those mappings and we can compare them. We can do what we call interferometry,
where we can take an image acquired on one day and combine it with an image acquired 12 days later from that same vantage point, looking at the same point on the ground. And when we do that, we can see the motion of the ground down to a fraction of the radar wavelength, which in this case is on the order of a few millimeters.
NISAR has two radars on it, two synthetic aperture radars. One is an L-band and the other is an S-band.
So it's kind of the Tesla or the Maserati of radars, whichever you think is cooler, I guess.
This here is the radar payload. That is the spacecraft bus. Large 12-meter reflector, common antenna system for both L-band and S-band to send out the RF signal and capture the return signal.
Good morning, Dr. Paul.
Antanu, how are you today?
Yeah, I'm fine.
And the pandemic is something that we were not counting on when we developed this project.
The NISAR project was actually pretty well versed with this remote operations because of that Indian engagement.
There was a little bit of WebEx fatigue, but I think we're learning how to do it better now.
But yeah, we're all in great spirits, and we will take a little hit to the schedule, but we've been waiting a long time for this mission, and we want to do it right. We want the hardware to work, and we want the science to be done.
One of the best things we can do to increase diversity in the sciences is to make it easier for people to enter the sciences.
The data is going to be freely available to everybody. We aren't going to have to pay for it like we do with some satellites.
So making the data free, having it easy to download to your own machine, all of that stuff is critical if we want to remove those barriers to entry to the field.
I'm looking forward to the sense of discovery that I think we're going to have when NISAR data start coming down.
Earth science is incredibly important to understand what's going on in the name of what our children and grandchildren are going to have to face in the future. And all the information we collect now is only going to help them understand that better and hopefully make their lives better.
Paul Rosen is the manager of NISAR at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena, California.
NISAR is a dual frequency L-band and S-band synthetic aperture radar mission that will map the Earth every 12 days from two directions such that we get effectively 1 week sampling of the Earth, all the land and all of the ice surfaces to measure its changes over time. SWEPSAR was effectively invented for this mission. It is needed in order to get the coverage and the sampling at the rates that we need it to make the science measurements that we want to make, yes. ISRO is building the S-band system and NASA is building the L-band system. The way we're synchronizing it is through a clock, basically a timing signal that comes from the L-band system and is sent directly to the S-band system. And in order for the S-band system to synchronize, it needs to read that clock and make sure that it turns on its radar precisely to within a fraction of a very small fraction of a second when the L-band system turns on, so that they are working together. They don't have conflicting measurements. The primary science objectives are cryosphere, studying the ice sheets and how they move and sea ice. That's related to climate and its variability. Looking at carbon and its change through looking at the forests, looking at deforestation and things like that. And then looking at solid earth and natural hazards, earthquakes, volcanoes. Those are the primary science objectives, but the applications are very, very broad, from agriculture to disaster response to coastal processes to ocean winds. It's just almost anything that you can use fast time series with radar, this has applicability.
88.3 Southern FM, the sounds of the Bayside.
Planet Earth is blue.
Welcome to the Jet Propulsion Laboratory, a NASA facility here in Southern California that specializes in the robotic exploration of Earth and space. I'm Marina Jurica, and we are very excited up here in the viewing gallery of the Space Assembly Building. And down below, you can see NISAR, and it is in the clean room below us, the next Earth Observing Satellite, which stands for NASA. ISRO, the Indian Space Research Organization we are teaming up with for this mission, Synthetic Aperture Radar. Here to break down how this satellite will give us a unique view of the Earth is NISAR's project scientist, Paul Rosen. Good afternoon, Paul.
Hi, Marina. Hi, everybody.
Now, tell me a little bit about what sets NISAR apart from other Earth satellites that are in orbit right now.
It's unique in almost every single way. It combines many different things, different techniques, and different modes. So we have two radars, one from the US, one from India. They're two different frequencies. So we can make color radar images of the Earth, which is unique. It also has polarimetric capability, which is a fancy way of saying that it has radar Polaroid glasses, which allows us to see the Earth in a particular way. Which is unique also. There's many, many other features as well. It strobes the Earth, measures the Earth every 12 days repeatedly over the life of the mission at high resolution and high temporal sampling, which allows us to make movies of the Earth effectively using this color Polaroid system. It's very, very, very cool.
Will the radar accurately see the surface of the Earth?
We will certainly make accurate measurements. This is designed specifically for accuracy in measuring very small motions of the Earth.
Now, NISAR is going to open our eyes to a potential of seeing the ground in many places that we haven't been able to see before. It's being called an all-weather satellite. Can you tell me what that means?
Yeah, well, by virtue of the radar wavelength, it's not sensitive to raindrops or cloud particles in any way. So we actually just penetrate right through that, unlike optical lights. And and bounce off the ground. It comes back through the clouds, and we can see it. So it doesn't matter whether it's raining or cloudy, we can see right through it. So it's all weather in that sense. We also have our own source of light. We generate the energy, transmit it, so it doesn't rely on sunlight. So in that sense, we're also day and night and all weather. So it's very, very powerful. We have reliable measurements at all times.
Day, night, no matter what kind of weather, and 24/7. Sounds like it's going to be working hard.
Oh, yeah. As will we, looking at the data.
Yes. Now, with the ability to see through anything, how will that help people deal with natural disasters like volcanoes or landslides?
Well, we take these data and we model them. We try to understand the physics of the Earth, and we can then take that knowledge from understanding the physics of the Earth and predict potentially how volcanoes will erupt. We can also monitor the motion of the Earth and see if it's starting to move before an eruption actually occurs, which then allows people to respond. They can evacuate if necessary, or just take other mitigation steps.
And early warnings are such a key when it helps those people during natural disaster events.
Absolutely, yeah.
Now, this is an incredible amount of data coming down. We've talked about this. It is just hard for me to even wrap my head around it. Can you make us understand how large a petabyte of data is?
Yeah, I was thinking about this. I've thought about this a lot, actually. You can think of it as something like 200,000 DVDs. So a DVD contains a movie, which a movie might be around 2 hours. So like 400,000 hours worth of movies, which if you were watching 24/7 would take you 45 years to get through. So it's a lot of data. Of course, we're not going to take 45 years to look at it. We use very fast computers to analyze it and reduce that data down to the scientific results that we're interested in.
But you will still be busy nonetheless.
Oh, yeah.
Excited, but busy.
Yes.
Can NISAR detect a volcanic eruption before it happens?
Yeah, so that's what I was saying earlier. We can monitor the motion of the ground down to a fraction of an inch as it's moving. So if there is pre-eruptive behavior, as they call it, then yes, we can see it inflating or deflating, moving around on the ground, and predict whether it will erupt or not.
That's really fascinating. And I briefly mentioned this earlier, but you partnered with ISRO to make this satellite. Can you tell me a little bit about why NASA chose to internationally collaborate?
Well, international collaborations are extremely important for a variety of reasons. All of the spacefaring nations, and other nations for that matter, are interested in the same kinds of things from a scientific and an applications point of view. We care about the Earth. We care about our people. We want to understand the Earth so that we can properly steward our resources and all the people that are in our countries. So ISRO and NASA share that common desire, and we know that radar is a very, very useful scientific tool for doing this. We each had our own ideas about putting radars in space. By collaborating, we can create a system that's even more powerful than any one nation could do by itself or could afford by itself. So it really helps share resources towards a common goal.
And we're looking at a launch date of next year.
Yeah, it's towards the end of next year. That's correct. The exact date is always a little uncertain because of the different things that happen during integration, but we're shooting for somewhere between October 22 and January 23, somewhere in that range.
We are in the Space Assembly Building here at NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory. The clean room is right down below me. And there's a lot of really amazing technological advances that are happening with this spacecraft. And here to talk to me a little bit about that is the instrument manager, Wendy Edelstein. Thank you so much for being here today, Wendy.
Thank you so much. I'm glad to be here.
And NISAR has a wavelength longer than most Earth satellites. Can you tell me what that's going to help it do?
Sure. So Paul talked a little bit about its capabilities with the longer wavelength. So you might think of the electromagnetic spectrum. So, you know, at the one end of the spectrum are those short wavelengths, you know, UV and X-rays and the visible light, and those have certain capabilities, but we're on the other end of the spectrum. We're at the RF, or radio frequency end of the spectrum, microwaves. And on that side, it's much longer wavelengths, about 10 centimeters. And from that, we can actually penetrate not just through the clouds that Paul mentioned, but also we can penetrate below the surface. So what we can actually see with this dual frequency system, so while the L-band system operates at about 10 inches, the S-band system that the Indians are providing is about 5 inches. And what that helps is the S-band system looks more at the vegetation and the crops and the things at the, on the surface level, and the L-band system can penetrate below that, look at the tree trunks where the carbon is, can look actually even at, penetrate the land surface, so they can actually look at more geological features. So combining these two systems, we actually have one of the most powerful systems that there's, that's ever been built. This long wavelength is, you know, that's why I said 24 centimeters, or lets us see right through the trees and all the leaves and get right down to the surface properties.
Which is really what sets NISAR apart.
That is right.
Right. No other satellite's been able to penetrate all of that 24/7.
Right. And with the two frequencies, we actually can do two things. We can penetrate, but we also can see the biomass or the trees and vegetation. So we can see both of them. And by combining all that data, they are seeing the world in a whole different way.
What is the projected longevity of this satellite?
So we design it to last 5 years, but generally, you know, when we build space systems, we build them to last. So we anticipate it could last 10 long or longer years, but, you know, we plan for 5. We hope for 10, 15, 20 years.
So does NISAR use solar panels for power?
Yes, we do.
And we have another feature on NISAR coming up right now.
Earth is a dynamic place, constantly moving and changing on timescales of seconds to eons and spatial scales of millimeters to the planet. NISAR is a science mission concept to measure and better understand dynamic changes of the solid Earth, ecosystems, and the cryosphere. Ice-covered regions of Earth experience seasonal growth and decay of ice and transport over the sea. Mountain glaciers are disappearing across the globe. And observations show large changes in the relentless flow of glaciers and ice streams in Greenland and Antarctica. Seasonal changes in vegetation cover and CO2 distribution are modulated over multi-year timescales by natural processes and the way we are shaping the planet. Fires account for a large fraction of the dynamics of land carbon. Scientists seek to gather an inventory globally of these changes and quantify their impact by estimating how much biomass is lost. Fires can rapidly move carbon stored in vegetation into the atmosphere and some into the oceans. And there are, of course, other kinds of fires also leading to dramatic changes and exchanges between the land and atmosphere. On the seasonal scale, in wetlands, floodwaters rise and recede. Scientists are interested in the timing of the onset of flooding and its total extent, as floodwater is a large contributor in moderating the interaction of the wetland ecosystem with the atmosphere. The solid Earth, including tectonic motions and volcanic activity, does not move with the seasons, but is restless on its own time scale. Here's one of the better-known active volcanoes, Mount Etna, in real time in the inset during the eruption, and over a span of years as measured by deformation interferometry. Scientists are interested in intermediate timescales as well, particularly during eruptive periods as they're assessing risks and forecasting eruptions. Volcanic eruptions impact aviation and can often place large populations living in proximity in great danger. Understanding their eruptive cycles and improving forecasts is a key objective for scientists. Flying along the San Andreas Fault in California, we see the result of repeated earthquakes that shape our landscape. Enormous destructive power released in seconds can have dire consequences in populated areas. Understanding earthquake potentials and potential mitigation approaches are important components of this mission. NISAR is conceived to regularly map the Earth with its synthetic aperture radar instrument to measure these changes and others. It is a culmination of years of conceptualizing how best to comprehensively cover Earth with fast sampling and excellent performance. The reflector feed combination for the NISAR instrument with digital beam tracking on receive would be an enabling technology for achieving dense spatial and temporal sampling. The instrument measures the reflection of the radar energy from the surface, from which we can make high-resolution images that tell us about what is on the surface.
NISAR would observe and quantify changes in forests over time. Changes in the water level in the understory can greatly affect carbon exchange in the atmosphere. For the solid earth and ice objectives, the technique we use is repeat pass interferometry. If we fly over a site repeatedly, we can measure the motion of the surface from one time to the next. The faults in Earth's crust in California can lead to large earthquakes. With the proposed frequent sampling and global perspective of NISAR, we hope to capture many years of earthquakes that in effect sample a longer time period at any one location. We have applied this method to areas imaged before and after the Christchurch earthquake in New Zealand, and have created a damage map within days of the earthquake that matches well with the ground observations collected over months, evocative of what we could do with NISAR. Similarly, we can apply these geodetic imaging time series to the understanding of aquifer depletion. These measurements show the detailed distribution of groundwater depletion up to 70 centimeters over a broad region of California's Central Valley. With water becoming a major concern around the world, this kind of monitoring is becoming more and more critical. Given this kind of variability, it isn't enough to make a single map cobbled together over time to understand what is going on. Scientists need more frequent and reliable data. The measurements just described will drive models, models of ice sheet and sea ice dynamics to better understand ice-ocean interactions, ecosystems dynamics models to understand carbon exchange, mechanical models of the Earth to improve our understanding of earthquake, volcanic, and other hazards, also climate and sea level rise models. As we go about our daily lives, often caught up in the cycles of our routines and human endeavors, it is easy to lose track of the changing world around us. But those changes are occurring, and they do have great relevance to our environment, availability, and need for resources, and overall safety and security. NISAR would be an exciting achievement for the U.S. and India, providing critical and unique data for many important and highly relevant science disciplines, as well as critical data in support of research in hazard monitoring and mitigation, carbon policy decision-making, understanding climate change and sea level rise, resource management, and a host of other applications.
One of the real key questions in our field of volcanology is to try to understand when is a volcano getting ready to erupt and when is something that we observe happening there just a natural process that isn't going to lead to eruption.
Deformation is often one of the first signs that a volcano is becoming restless. And then we also look for increased seismic activity. But the earlier that we can detect that deformation, the more we can refine what kind of a forecast we have and whether or not we need to be concerned about eruptions.
NISAR has a couple of capabilities that are going to be really transformative for volcanology. The first is the consistency. The fact that we're going to get these incredible data very consistently, every couple of weeks. The other aspect of NISAR that's very important is its wavelength. It's got a longer wavelength than most satellite missions that have taken radars up into space. And that longer wavelength means that we're going to be able to penetrate vegetation and be able to see the ground through trees. We're going to get consistency and we're going to get the ability to see through a lot of this obscuring vegetation. And that's really going to open the door for studies of volcanoes.
Because it's expensive and dangerous to put ground sensors around many of the world's volcanoes, many volcanoes around the world have no sensors on them or too few sensors to really understand what's happening.
Having something that's completely remote and satellite-based allows us to get an image of what's going on without needing to have something in the remote ground surface.
The thing about volcanoes is they could have a regional or even a global impact depending on the size of the eruption.
So it's really key to be able to understand how volcanoes work so we can better forecast their activity and warn people that might be impacted by eruptions.
So that is going to be quite a mission to look forward to. NISAR, joint mission between NASA and India. Well, this has been The Space Show. I'm Andrew Rennie, and we'll have possibly more about planet Earth next week, and maybe a look at some of the results from the Chinese mission to the moon. Coming up is Purple Haze with Wayne Kramer.